Evening, everyone. You please join me in prayer. O Heavenly Father.
O Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
Beloved Jesus Christ.
Beloved Jesus Christ.
Blessed Master.
Blessed Master.
Saints and sages of all religions.
Saints and sages of all religions.
I bow to all of you.
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles.
Free my life from all obstacles.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king.
Be thou the only king.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Oh. Oh. Peace.
Peace.
Bliss.
Bliss.
Amen. It's wonderful to see you all again. Time is a funny thing. One day can, especially when you're traveling and pilgrimage, can seem like many days or weeks or months all packed into one day's experience. And then gone for so long and then come back and it's like never been gone at all. So it's... Einstein said that time was relative, and I think that's true. It's a very interesting pilgrimage going to India. Why to go? I can only say that I felt the inner prompting to go. And I felt that I must go. So we packed up everything in our house, and we left. And the... meaning of the journey, the purpose of it, gradually unfolded each day as we were there. And as you might suspect, there are many meanings, there are many purposes to it all. But when we arrived at Anandashram, which is such a beautiful place in Kerala state in the south of India, you have to excuse me a little bit, I have a cold in my voice. Isn't all that it should be, so we'll see how it holds out. We arrived there and we were received with so much love, so much hospitality, and everything there is done so that while you're there, you have really no excuse not to put your mind totally upon God. And that was the purpose for which the ashram was at the... so that individuals could come and put concentrated effort into their complete and total realization. Now, whether the individual takes full advantage of that or not is up to them. But that's the purpose for which it was created. And while I was there, there were many individuals who came. And some of them came in very mysterious kinds of ways. But they all came for some teachings and for some upliftment. I wanted to read to you about one of these individuals. He's an absolutely tremendous soul. He's a Muslim. His name is Aziz. And the very day that I came to Ananda Ashram, he started feeling an inner prompting to come to the ashram. He had heard of it before, but he had never been there. And it was inexplicable to him why he should feel such a desire to go to Ananda Ashram. Well, several days went by, and the inner prompting came stronger and stronger until he couldn't avoid it. He told his wife was going. She asked why. He says, "I don't know." Says, "I'll tell you when I get back." On his way, a doctor friend of his who had seen me at the ashram said, "If you're going to Ananda Ashram, you have to see David." So he came and he saw me, and he felt that was the reason why he was getting this inner prompting to come to Ananda Ashram. So you see how God works. It's wonderful. And so this is one of our meetings, and he came pronaming at my feet. I ask for your grace that I might attain realization. My response, grace is already present. You have only to open the door. Faith opens the door. Doubt closes it. Disease. Then give me your grace to remove my doubts. Respond, as I said, grace is already there. It has stirred you to seek God. It is like a pebble in your shoe. It will not leave you undisturbed. Others do not care about God at all. You have a pain in your heart that seeks God's liberation. That is good. It is a sign of grace at work. The thing you must do is to seek God. That opens the door. Think on your Master. Grace flows to you through your thoughts, your faith, your love. These open the door of grace even further. Disease. I don't see God in everyone. I have a superiority complex. I see some as lower than me. Give me the grace to see God in everyone. My response. First, practice seeing God in everyone. That does not mean you greet everyone you see on the street or invite them home to dinner. See that it is God who is underneath the mask of every person you see. Papa told the story. A mother was telling her young child some stories. The mother thought that it would add to the storytelling to wear masks. So one day she donned a scary mask while telling the story. At first the child was really frightened by the mask. Then the child thought, I think that is my mother behind the mask. The child reached up and slowly pulled down the mask. And what did the child see? The smiling face of its mother. Disease. Oh, that is a wonderful story. Yes, likewise, learn to see it is your divine mother, God, who is behind the mask of every person you meet. At first, it is the practice of the mind. Later, the reality is that you see God in everyone, in everything, in the air surrounding you, within your heart as well. It reminds me of a time when I asked Mother a question because I had been feeling God inside of me so greatly. The spiritual power was flowing up my spine. I could feel the bliss and the joy of God. And yet, when I opened these two eyes for my meditation, I was caught into the world of duality. I didn't see individuals, other people, other situations as being filled with God. You see, my mind had not yet been purified so that that universal vision could dawn within me. So I had more work to do. And Mother responded to my question about seeing God outside of me, or my lack of ability of being able to see God outside of me. And she said, first you find God within you, and then you see Him everywhere about you. This is a great journey that we have embarked upon. It is a wonderful journey, but it is also a journey that is filled with difficulties. Not that God places difficulties in front of us, but that we have to face all of those things that we have done in our outward journey away from God. The moment we said the word I in an egotistical sense, we were from that point on separated from the divine union that we had once enjoyed. Now, in a very real way, we can never be separated from God. God, who is the sole creator, God, who has made everything that is, including ourselves, God, who is the sole source of life, of intelligence, of everything that there is. And we could not exist without the ongoing power and grace of the divine. However, within the mind, we seem to feel a sense of separation
And so we make our decisions based upon the little human ego and the mind. And it is a poor instrument, ultimately, to make the decisions to guide our lives by, and yet that is the experience that we have wanted. And so while we are within the great body of God, we seem to be in a world of separation. When we begin to awaken to the fact that we are no longer satisfied living in a world of separation, that is when we put our feet truly on the spiritual path, and not until then. There are many people who belong to religions. But religion does not guarantee that an individual is on the spiritual path towards higher consciousness. There are many ways to take religion. Some people take it as a set of ethics, morals, and laws. And these are good things. They help to purify the mind, but they are not yet entering, really, on the higher spiritual path. There are others who get caught up in the organization, in who's who and what's what, and memorizing scriptures and all the rest of it that have to do with the mind alone and interpersonal relations with other people. And again, this can have a place. This can be a good thing. But it is no substitute for being able to lift the consciousness into Christ consciousness. This is the purpose for which Christ was born, was to teach all humanity that I and my Father are one. You see, before that, there is no real concept in Western thought that man and God could be joined and become as one. So Jesus came as a demonstration of that. And yoga means to be one with the infinite source for which you have come. So it's through the following the way of the Christ, which is what Jesus came to show us. Not that we have to be nailed to a wooden cross, but that this cross is the body. When you stand with your feet together and your arms outstretched, you are in the form of a cross. When I was in Chennai, which used to be called Madras, it is the place where it is said that St. Thomas, the disciple of Jesus, traveled to. And he set up 7 churches in the state of Kerala. Then he moved on over to the East Coast. And there he set up several other churches. But he disturbed the populace, as in the case in Rome and Greece, Christianity broke the rules of caste. It said anyone could rise into that higher state of consciousness. Whereas before in India, that was reserved as the right of the Brahmins. And as the caste system had evolved originally, it was for those who had the ability would go into that caste. But eventually, it became solidified into a blood relation thing, much like the blue bloods of Europe. And so, it was what family you were born into rather than your own abilities. And this was due to the fact that the earth was going into a cycle of ignorance and darkness. And this ignorance began to distort the truth that had originally been given. So instead of simply being a descriptor of the various kinds of consciousness that man came to explore in his lifetime, it became a rigid system in which no one could go beyond what they were born into. And so this distortion was something that has been carried on even to some aspect to this day, although it is changing a great deal. So St. Thomas came, and he came with this message of liberation. and that all people, whatever caste you were born to, could experience that inner liberation, that salvation. And so there was a lot of resistance to St. Thomas, and eventually he was killed for his efforts. But there is a beautiful basilica that is there in Chennai that holds some of the remnants of this saint. There is a cave where he once resided, and the feeling there is terrific. It is an uplifting, it is a powerful feeling. But this represents the truth that Jesus lived, a great master lived. And whether he had the specific life that is described in the Gospels or not, whether every word of it is an exact historical truth, the fact is that some great soul had come into the world and was guiding and directing those who were spawning these tremendous, powerful ideas that were going out, that salvation was for all mankind. And not only was that a revolutionary idea to the Greeks and to the Romans and to the Jews, but it was also, to some extent, in India as well, even though they had originally authored those ideas that God and man can become one and become a God-man, God-woman. It's not a gender thing. It's just simply a description that the human can become one with the divine. This introduced a whole new idea into the West. But the West could not fully accept this idea at the time. So they relegated the idea of a God-man to one individual, Jesus Christ. Rather than being a universal man, he became a specific historical figure. This was a distortion of the original truth that had been given. And yet it's understandable that the human mind is resistant to thinking of itself as having a divine nature. When we look inside of ourselves and we don't dive deep enough, all we see is the human. And there can be darkness of warfare within the human. There can be desire natures that we do not associate with God. And we look at that and we say, that's not pure. That's not light. How can divinity be existing within me? Well, the answer is that in many cases, it's lying dormant. It has a seed that is deep within you, but it may be covered by many, many layers of human consciousness. And so we have to go about removing those layers of human consciousness. We have to penetrate deeper. We have to make the mind still. Because this mind is always in the business of creating. It always wants to do more. It always wants to create more. And this is just spinning one web of delusion after another. It is not that creating is bad or evil in itself. But when it obscures our vision of divinity, lying both within us and everywhere about us, then it serves as a barrier, and it has usurped the proper king, so to speak. And the ego has become king, and the soul lies dormant, unseen and unheard. In order to awaken the divinity within, we have to search it out. We have to enter upon the path. We have to make the effort. We know that to attain anything in this world of value, we have to make an effort. If you ever want to start your own business, if you ever want to create something, you have to put your will into it. You have to have an idea about what you want and what you want to create. And then you have to go about doing it. And realization of God is not different. Because we have to make the effort. We have to go through day to day striving to realize our divine union with God. And this is no easy task because there are many things that come up in our life that demand our attention, that draw us away from this internal search. And unless and until we come to that point where we are willing to set aside the little things of this world, at least for a portion of the day, and fix our minds fully upon the divine within, then we will make no spiritual progress. We will not enter into that inner kingdom of heaven. We must set aside the things of this world. We must love God more than we love the world. And when we do that, then we are drawn towards that divine presence that is awakening within ourselves. We don't have to go far. Going on a pilgrimage is one way that God goes about helping us to awaken us. But it is not the only way, and it is not essential. There are many great masters and many great saints who never left their hometown. Kabir never left Benares. Lari Mahasaya never left Benares, very rarely. They stayed at home, but they did their practice. And through their spiritual practice, their mind was gradually purified until they came to that mountain peak where they could see everything of their own true nature. Lari Mahasaya has left some wonderful diaries. And in those diaries, he describes on a daily basis how his meditation deepens and the experiences that he comes when he focuses his mind at the ajna, or this third eye point, the kutastha. And it is there that this light begins to unfold. The tremendous sound of Om begins to resound in him. Now when you see this light at the ajna, when you hear that vibration of Om, let your mind rest in that. And that power, that grace that emanates from that light and that sound will gradually purify your entire being. When you get around some meditators, they have these sticks that form a cross that they put their elbows upon. And they cover their ears and they put their hands on their eyes so that they can draw the mind inside. But at some point, such devices are not needed at all. Anytime I focus my mind upon the medulla oblongata, at the base of the skull and the back of the head, I feel and I hear that Om sound. And it comes to me oftentimes without any effort at all. It is just simply there. It is the sound of the vibration of the running of this universe. It is a substratum of energy and vibration that runs out throughout all this universe. And when you hear it inside of you, your consciousness expands out naturally. It is like riding a wave that takes you further and further out. Now, when we first enter into this, sometimes we can get scared. We start to move out and out like that. And suddenly we think, oh my, what will happen to me here? Perhaps I will move out in such a way that I won't be able to find my way back. But this is a delusional voice. And if you follow that expanding wave that moves out and out, you will find yourself right within your own heart. You really haven't gone anywhere at all. And yet the feeling is that you've expanded out to the size of this universe, perhaps even beyond. This is entering into universal consciousness. And Jesus said, in my Father's kingdom, there are many mansions. There are many states of consciousness. There are many things to attain to. And you never run out of them. You just keep exploring the vast body of God. And it is the most interesting, the most fascinating, the most powerful, the most intelligent thing that you can possibly imagine. And so it's not just a thing of one day you find realization and that's the end of life. How boring. Nor is heaven sitting up on some pink cloud, strumming on some harps. How long would that entertain you? After a few days of that, you'd feel like going stark raving mad if you didn't have something to do. God is so much beyond anything that the mind can conceive. And to put him into a little box and say, all right, I have a label for him, I have a box for him, that does it. Now I can go on my way. It is a disservice to yourself and to the infinite. Because you are not really exploring the great body of God. Just think of the intelligence that has gone into making up this universe. Look at some of these photos of from the Hubble spacecraft and other telescopes. Of the vastness of this universe, of its beauty, of its design. And that is just one little aspect of the intelligence and the creativity and the beauty of the infinite consciousness. Look at a leaf, a flower, its complexity, its beauty, its utility. It is all a reflection of the divine mind. Look at a bee if it lands on your hand and just observe it. See what a fantastic creature this thing is. And on you can go through all nature, which is just but a vague shadow reflection of the infinite divine consciousness. And then just think of gaining access to that divine consciousness. And not only the intelligence, but the bliss, the beauty, and the joy. Fill your cup up of consciousness so much that it overflows. You cannot contain it all. That is the beauty. That's the joy that is awaiting for you. And it's not something that you have to settle for just to have as an occasional peep into the kingdom. But to enter in with both of your feet. To know that it is one with yourself. And it was for this reason that Jesus, that Rama, that Krishna, and Buddha, and all the great ones have been born into this world, is to awaken mankind to their divine nature. But instead, organizations and new religions and then fighting over what the name of God is, all begins and the real goal is totally lost sight of. This goal and the discovery of it must be renewed with each generation. You are the vanguard. You are the explorers. And if you are not joined by everybody that you know, then just know that those who are explorers, those who go out and tread new territory, they are, by virtue of that exploration, on their own to some extent. So don't be bothered that the rest of the world may not be joining you in this. And besides, when you look at the craziness that the world gets itself into, why would you want to follow it anyway? Why not go into the laboratory of your own being? Why not go into a spiritual pilgrimage right where you find yourself. And you do that by beginning to get quiet in the mind. And when you get quiet and you begin to listen to God, then God takes you on this tremendous adventure. Read you one of my other notes from India, and this one is entitled Proselytizing Indian Style. On April 4th, while staying at the Hotel Asha, we were walking about the small market. An Indian man and two friends approached us. "Are you a Christian?" he asked. I looked at this man, asking this out-of-the-blue question. "Yes and no," I reply. Anytime I'm asked this question, I find different answers coming out. "Do you believe God exists in Haridwar?" he continued. "Yes, of course. He is also here." "Where?" he asked, looking around. "Where do you see him here?" "Right here," I said, patting him on the chest. He said, startled at the assertion, "Only the Atman exists here." "Atman and Paratman," I rejoin, "is the bubble one with the sea. Atman in this case is this individual soul. And Paratman is that which is the supreme soul of the universe, or God consciousness." So he is saying the soul exists within man, but God consciousness does not. "Atman and Paratman," I rejoin, "the bubble is one with the sea." "No, Atman is not the same as Paratman. My guru, Swami Sadananda, can explain it all to you. You see him in Haridwar. No cost. If you like him, then give him something." "I cannot agree with what you say, my friend," I answered. "God is within you in all of his purity. I see that clearly." "No," was his vehement reply. "Only the Atman is inside, not the Paratman. I am a doctor. You see my guru, Swami Sadananda." I replied, "If that is what your guru teaches, I cannot agree, nor does my guru." He asked, "Who is your guru?" "Mother Hamilton is my guru, and her guru, Paramahansa Yogananda, would agree with what I say as well. And my Parampara Guru, Sri Yukteswar, and my Parampara Guru, Lari Mahasya, would say what I am saying." "Lari Mahasya, I have heard of him. But you come see my Guru." I looked at this man. He looked dull, lifeless, repeating his maxim. His two friends looked even duller and listlessly following this man. I answered, "If God wills," I said, "I will come." He wrote on a paper the name and address of his teacher, who appeared to insist on duality. Jesus describes such men as wolves dressed in a sheep. May the idea of separation die in the ashes of the fire of wisdom. So you get many people coming to you. It's always an interesting experience to be in India. So this man came up out of the blue and started this conversation and made these assertions. You see, not everyone who comes, speaking of God, speaking of realization, speaking of truth, has realized that within them. There are many people who have learned a little. Perhaps they have had some experiences, but they have not had the full complement. And as a result of that, they take a little bit of what they know and they begin to teach that as the truth. But for truth to be realized in its entirety requires complete surrender of the human ego. And that is not something that is easy to do, because we fight for our own existence. And We feel that as if we surrender ourselves completely, some aspect of ourselves will die. And it is true that there is some part of us that will die, but that is the idea of separation. So you cannot take your ego with you into this place of realization, but rather it takes this complete self-surrender. That is a beautiful moment you see in the scriptures of the West. In Genesis, we learn where Adam and Eve assert their own desire nature. I want what I want, says the ego, and I don't care what divine consciousness says about it. And so that is the beginning of separation, and all other ills and difficulties stems from that. And then so many lives are described, so many realized beings to some degree, Moses and Ezekiel, Elijah, they all go through their various experiences. And some of them are great in God. But it's not until Jesus comes that that absolute and complete surrender is there. In the Garden of Gethsemane, not my will, but thy will be done. And this perfectly reflects the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita and the teachings of the Buddha. Not my will, but thy will. And when you willingly surrender yourself in this great degree, then God is allowed full and supreme access to every aspect of who and what you are. And the alchemy of transformation occurs at that point. And you feel yourself born new in this Christ consciousness. This is the truth that Jesus came to give. But who knows it? Who knows it? Very few. But when we put our feet truly on this path, then we really begin to live. And yes, there are difficulties that come with it. Yes, we are challenged to the nth degree. But we count that as very little in comparison to what we gain in the end. So, my friends, I invite you to enter into your pilgrimage right where you stand and to continue on with all sincerity, with your whole heart, your mind, and your soul. And let us all return to God together. Let us realize Him in greater and greater degree. From this day forward, with renewed dedication to realizing that infinite consciousness that resides latent within every man. Are there any questions or thoughts on anything I've spoken on tonight?
So what is the difference between having self-esteem and the ego?
Ego consciousness is, by its very nature, is anything that thinks of itself as being separate from its divine nature. But in all the ancient scriptures are the animal sacrifices. And in India, what you see, for instance, in front of the Shiva temple is Nandi the bull, who's down on his knees looking in towards Shiva. The animal sacrifices and the image of Nandi or any of the other animals in submission to the deity is our own animal nature that has been subdued. But unless you have self-mastery, you can't surrender yourself. You can't bring yourself to that point. You have a rebellious bull that charges around in the china closet. And many bulls carry around their own china closet with them, so wherever they go, they get to smash whatever's there. So we can work on the ego. We can work on gaining good self-esteem, a good image, because a strong ego is actually needed in order to be able to surrender it. A whole ego is needed. And if our ego is too damaged or too shattered through life's experiences, then we won't be able to bring ourselves to really let it go and surrender it. So we can simultaneously be building up the ego, which seems to be against being able to surrender it. Sorry about my voice. But actually they can work in concert together. So we can continue to build ourselves as professionals, as human beings, and to round ourselves out and to have a healthy ego. And one way of thinking of it is it's fattening up of the calf before you sacrifice it. You want a nice offering, huh? You don't want some skeleton that you're putting out there. So you're making yourself more whole, more complete, so that you can bring yourself to that point where you can surrender that completely. And if we find ourselves too scattered, too shattered, as I say, through life experiences, we won't be able to do that. So many people are involved in building up the ego, but there's healthy ways of doing that. And then there's, at some point, we come to the place where we're no longer just building up the ego, but we're also surrendering. And you can actually be doing a little bit of both at the same time. Building up the ego, making it more whole, making it more perfect, making it more rounded out. And at the same time, surrendering it up to God. Because ultimately what happens is that it's not that we disappear as individuals. This Atman is the pure soul that is within. And as the human ego is surrendered up, the divine ego, or the Atman, begins to fill itself out. And then you see within that one that they act as another person may act, but they're not motivated by human motivations. They're motivated through divine will, and divine will expresses itself perfectly through them. So it can appear that they act with an ego as anybody else acts with an ego. But if we were to proceed deeper into their nature, we would say that they're not being driven by the things of the ego. They're an expression of divinity. And this is how God meant for us to live. This is the so-called fall of man, is that he gravitated towards the human ego instead of remaining as a divine expression. So our goal is to regain that divine expression. And then we can breathe, and we can move, and we can act as anybody else does. But our internal experience and where that motivation for action comes is completely different. And we know the difference. When we see somebody who's really just trying to be a better person and working on their ego that way, we know the difference between that and somebody who's a supreme egotist. It's evident to us. And in one sense, somebody who has a poor self-image, they're just as consumed as the person who the egotist is. They're they're filled with themselves and seeing their own reflection everywhere they go. But the one who's sincerely working on themselves is gradually freeing themselves of the effects of the ego. Whereas the egotist is not interested in that. They want power, they want domination, they want gratification of the ego. And it's ultimately a pathetic game, because it can't ever really be had through the ego. So the ego is always left wanting. Wanting something more. And that's the pebble that's in the shoe. Won't leave you alone. No matter how much you try to kick it out, the shoe stays there. It irritates, moves you off. That desire for more, that desire for fulfillment, for perfection. And when God is moving through us in that way, we can't avoid Him. He is unavoidable. And gaining our realization becomes unavoidable. Master Love, the poem, The Hound of Heaven, in which God is perceived as the hound that's chasing the man. Man is running away, desperately trying to get away. But the hound is always just a few feet behind him, always gaining, gaining, gaining. How lovely to think that God is pursuing us. My Papa said, don't run after God. Just stand still and let God come to you. Trust that God is awakening Himself in you. And when we look at our own human nature, we think, oh my gosh, there's so far to go. But it's one of my favorite analogies, a room that's been darkened for 1,000 years. And one day somebody throws open the window and all this light comes streaming in. And suddenly darkness that seemed to be the unchallenged emperor for so many thousands of years is completely vanquished in a moment. As the light comes in, darkness is sent running away. And that light opens up inside of you. All the darkness is vanquished in a second. In a second. Think of yourself groping around in a dark room. Suddenly somebody switches on the light. Ah, there everything is. Now I'm no longer tripping over the chairs and benches. All the things here I can see clearly. And divine consciousness awakens in you, and suddenly you see clearly. Some of it is self-effort, and self-effort is required. But the real power that awakens inside of you is grace. And grace is a power and intelligence that's beyond you. And so when you feel that grace is in operation in you, all you need to do is to open yourself to grace. And how much easier that is than to feel like you have to run out after it. A beautiful saying in the beginning of John, to all them who received Him, gave He power to become sons of God. Received Him. Be receptive. Work on your receptivity, your openness. The problem is we get consumed with the world, we get consumed with our fears, and we close it off. Work on being receptive. Work on being open, malleable. Like soft clay that God can mold into whatever shape and form He desires. And then just feel the joy of being His instrument. Let go of your mind's evaluation. Well, it should be different than this. It should be better, it should be more, it should be whatever it is. no, it's perfect in this moment. This is perfect in this moment. There's no place I'd rather be. There's nothing else I'd rather be doing. It's perfect. And when you can really let that in, that's bliss. And you feel it. And peace. Every moment holds eternity within it. That's the divine promise. But who can receive it? That's the challenge. So by all means, work on the personality, make it better, improve self-esteem and all the rest of it. But realize also, beyond your own self-effort, there is a divine alchemy going on. So that these invisible and unseen forces are coming in and supporting you. And enabling you to make the real change. And all the great masters, when they feel that come in, they recognize that's not me. I wouldn't have the intelligence to know to do that. I wouldn't have the power to be able to be uplifted in that manner. All of these things are somehow beyond me and yet intimately connected with me. It's not like some foreign power has come into me. It feels so intimate and so close. So good and so pure. And yet, I know that that's not me. That's not the little human ego that's trying to make that happen. I couldn't. But God can. Isn't that comforting? Wonderful. It's just dependent on this human mind and this human ego, my God. How long would that take?
My mind is crazy.
Yeah. You know, and that's as far as Freud went. Freud said, well, the best you can do is to manage to minimalize your neurosis. You know, become less neurotic. That's as good as it gets.
It's problems and there's none.
And if you saw it as the job of the mind, oh, yeah, what could it do? Very little. Very little. But divine grace comes in and it changes the whole story. You feel that great love of God. Great peace of God, a great presence within you. You know you're in touch with something that is far beyond anything your little Swami Satchitananda would say, your puny little mind could know. Reminds me of a story when I was at Dwarhat, the ashram there. There's a man who was an electrical engineer and a scientist, and we were talking about the power of prayer. And so he said, well, one day that he was doing an experiment, and for that experiment, they had to have this furnace that was running at 12,000 degrees. 12,000 degrees. And for 6 or 8 hours, the experiment had been going well. They had to run it for 24. And then for some reason, they never knew why, the temperature began to drop. And it went down to 1150. Oh my gosh. I was starting to really get nervous. And then it went down to 11. People were panicking. If it dropped below 1,000, the experiment was ruined. So he went inside and he thought of God. And he said, Lord, I'm not bothering you. Why are you bothering me? I'm not bothering you. Why are you bothering me? And suddenly the idea came into his mind, and he told the technician, he says, turn the furnace on. What? We'll lose everything. Nope, turn it off. So the technician went over and he turned the furnace off and dropped down to 10,050. And then he said, okay, turn it back on. Turned it back on and it came up to full temperature. And it worked perfectly through the whole rest of the experiment. They could never get that furnace to work again after that. But for that time, it held out perfectly and they got the 12,000 degrees. So, by going inside and attuning himself, then God paved the way for something to work. But I thought that was wonderful. I'm not bothering you. Why are you bothering me? Prayer works. It's powerful. We're given these tools, but do we utilize them? Do we utilize them? Papa Ramdas just simply got that instruction. Chant God's name always. Chant God's name always. He took that one simple thing. Other people, thousands of others heard it. But he applied it. And that was the difference. And it changed his entire life. Never to be the same. How many truths do we hear? How many techniques are we taught? We're taught just a few simple techniques. But if we take them, if we apply them, and we make the best use of them, we have everything that's required to take us to God in a very speedy manner. But who does it? Who applies it? That's the difference between those who make it and those who fall away. It's not that hard. It's much harder to carry around this ego. It's much harder to take the effects of the things that we've done in ignorance. That's the hard thing. But we act as if we're going to scream and howl to the heavens that something's been taken away from us if we surrender to God. All that's taken away is our misery. What's given to us are the good things of life. But it does require that we surrender ourselves, heart, mind, and soul. And what we are given in return is so much greater than anything that we have ever given up. Now, right now, I don't have a specific home. And yet I have homes all over the world. There's a young boy at the ashram who said, I want to be a Swami. Now, to set the context for this, different people will come and give Swami Satchidananda a ride all the time. So this boy is seeing cars come and go and Swami getting in and leaving and coming back. So somebody says, why do you want to be a Swami? Because I want to have a lot of cars. So in one sense, when we give up everything, then everything is ours. You see, we're afraid to do that. What will happen to me? Who will take care of me? But what freedom there is, the human ego lets go. Most of us, that's a gradual path. We can't do it all in one day, all in one moment. But if we could, we would have absolute freedom like that. We can have it in this moment. This moment itself. Bliss that I feel, joy that I feel, the communion with God that I feel in this moment is available to everyone. Why not? Why not? Any other thoughts, questions? Everyone must be in the ocean of Satchitananda.
I don't like to change the subject, but will somebody take me to the washroom, please?
Power of the immediacy of now.
Thank you. I'm sorry to disturb.
And it reminds me in an odd way that Master used to say, if you can imagine not being able to sleep for 10 or 12 days, and then suddenly getting the opportunity to lay down your head and go to sleep, how joyful that would be. God is a million times more joyful than that moment of going to sleep. Perhaps having to believe ourselves. I was all of that and more. You see, we don't believe it. We don't believe it. That's why we dally. We don't really believe God is what he's built to be. Yeah, that sounds all right, but, you know, what about my business? Or what about my family? Or what about my home? Won't I lose out? The reality is God built your business. God built your home. God built your family. He's given you every single thing that you have. Why should you cut yourself off from him, the giver? I appear to be sitting here in a body. What I experience is floating in an ocean of spirit. See how appearances can be deceiving. Smith called it living in two worlds. Really, those two worlds are one world. Because there's only one consciousness, there's only one God. We have to devise ways of talking about it to try to make sense to the mind.
Oh, my intake of fluid through the day.
watching the show, just happened to turn on the channel, and, you know, how people praying, and I thought, oh, this is interesting. And it was Jewish people, Christian people, and the Jewish people needed to have, wanted to have, these other people wanted to have the cemetery cleared away of all these prickly vines and plants. And so the Christian people helped them, you know, do this, and without gloves, just, you know, and this fellow was talking about it, and he was shocked. He was shocked that Christian people were actually helping Jewish people. And I was watching this and why? It's beautiful. And although he was very touched by this, but
should be how life is.
Yeah.
Seems so self-evident. And yet we live in a world where that's not the case, and people argue over what the name of God is. Only what I call God is the true God. And everybody else is wrong. But real spiritually alive people don't speak that way. Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita said, it's the new philosopher who speaks in that way. The realized philosopher never speaks that way. And while a realized master may show preference to a certain religion, spiritual tradition, the recognition of a real master is they know, they see, they can perceive that spiritual experience comes in all the different religions, and the highest truth is there in all the great religions. It's not different than a grieving mother who's lost her child. The same grief would be felt by a mother in India as in Africa, as in China, as in Europe, as in America, as in South America, as in Australia. The experience is universal. The language that is used, the expression of grief, may vary, but the feelings are the same. And when you see someone who is lifted up to God, it is the same if that one is Christian or Muslim or Jewish, Hindu, Buddhist, Taoist, it makes no difference. The language of expression may vary, but the experience is the same. And to think anything else is just utter foolishness. It's tribalism, it's pride, it's fear. But it's not God. That's right. Look at the flowers. There's kind of a ridiculous amount of variety, really. And I think it's one of the biggest arguments against strict Darwinism. Just look at the variety. It's not utilitarian. Darwinism should be very utilitarian. Whatever is most efficient, that will trump over everything else. But you look at these intricate designs of flowers, the beauty, and the variety. There's no need for all of that. It's a little bit of a waste, don't you think? But we love it. And we love it because our Creator loves it. We're a perfect reflection of our Creator. consciousness can meditate upon a flower and experience ecstasy at its exquisite beauty and perfection. Why are our minds so dull as not to be able to perceive that? Get equal joy out of the beauty of a flower, a delightful smile of a child, wizened eyes of an ancient lady. Why are we so dull to life? Because we're dead to God. It's a wonderful story about Swami Ramdas, who was a disciple of Yogananda after Master's passing, went to Papa, and he asked Papa, he says, will you be my guru? And Papa says, you have a guru, Yogananda. Oh no, my guru's dead. You're dead. Your guru still lives. Who is dead? Man was spiritually dead. And I woke him up and shocked him. As he needed to be shocked. Sometimes we need to be shocked. We need something to wake us up. So we're like the teenager who keeps rolling over and going back to sleep, dreaming another dream. Sometimes we need a little bucket of cold water on us to get us going. Not that we don't complain about the bucket of cold water. Of course we do, bitterly. But it does get us out of bed. Tremendously privileged to be with you here tonight. Divine vibration is very powerful. Let's carry that with us, guarding it as our most precious secret attainment. Sharing it with all the world. Let us close with some omens. Peace. Bliss.
Bliss.
Amen.